welcome to the EMS Educast. And today we got a repeat guest, one of our favorite people who is, we had such a great episode with him before. David Page has come by to talk about a program that he's been working on recently, the EMS Academy for Low Income Youth. And he's going to tell us about his trials and tribulations and his wins and his frustrations with that. But as always, we have a round table of good guests tonight and hosts. And as always, we have Greg Freese. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well, Buck, and it's great to have Dave back, and I'm looking forward to hearing about this EMS Academy in St. Paul.
Awesome. Hey, Rob. We have Rob Terrio from Ontario. How are you doing, buddy?
Hey, Buck. I'm doing very well tonight. Thanks. I'm actually podcasting from my office at the college tonight, so it's like a ghost town in here. It's weird.
It's weird to be where you work after hours sometimes, isn't it? It's just got a whole different feeling. It's like you're getting away with something.
I think I hear the cleaning lady coming in. Either that or I'm about to be robbed. So if you hear a scream, just
we'll help you.
Georgian College, Barrie, Ontario, call the police.
Okay. And tonight we have a new one. Doug Godomsky is with us. How are you doing?
Well, pretty good. And greetings from, somewhat sunny Albuquerque today. And work down here at the University of New Mexico. And
I was about to say, tell us a little bit about yourself so the listeners are kind of up to speed with you.
Well, after a whole lot of years at the EMS Academy there at the university, teaching mostly paramedic stuff and all that, about 3 years ago, stepped over to the dark side at the hospital and got into Clinhead in their human simulation program. And I tell you what, it's fun going home some days realizing I just spent the whole day training physicians. Not something a paramedic typically gets to do, and nursing staff, all that stuff. So with the School of Medicine, and it's really fun to yank their chain.
And tonight we have David Page, who is the guest tonight, here to talk about his EMS Academy for Low-Income Youth. Now, have you been doing since last time we talked to you?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. That's wonderful, and I'm very glad to be back. I want to tell you a little bit about this EMS Academy. It's the brainchild of Chief Tim Butler and the Equal Opportunity Office, a woman by the name of Luz Frias, who works in the city of St. Paul. And they both saw an opportunity to use some stimulus grant money for youth that the city had obtained over the summer, mostly for parks and recreation jobs, for youth to work in the Parks and Rec Department, to maybe train some kids, especially kids that were coming from low socioeconomic backgrounds, to qualify for the entrance exam for the St. Paul Fire Department as firefighters. The department requires you to be an EMT before you take the written and practical, the agility test. So you have to be an EMT, and the number of EMTs in the area, as you can well imagine, that are of diverse ethnic backgrounds are not very significant. So that's what we set out to do, and we had very little time to do it. We had about 6 weeks to get the word out. I'm sorry, we had 10 weeks to spend the money, 12 weeks to spend the money, 1 week to put it together, and 1 week to let people know that if they wanted to join, they could join. Luckily, the city already had a self-selected pool of people who had said they wanted to be part of the Youth Job Corps that's part of the city. And so there were, I don't know, about 400 youth that already were placed into various jobs, and some that were waiting to be placed that had expressed interest in something like this. So we assembled the folks we could on short notice and let them know what was going on and that we'd like to have them participate in the academy and that they would be paid to do so. This was a $7.50 an hour job for them through the Parks and Rec Department. And it was about 20 to 25 hours a week for 10 weeks. And that is what we're just barely, actually we're in the ninth week. Next week is our final week in graduation. And that's how that story went. We initially, the mayor's office was looking to train 40 individuals, and we really thought it would be more realistic to train two groups of 20 only because of the cost associated with, or the difficulties in putting 40 people in a classroom, and the number of skills required and the number of instructors required to break the skill ratio down. And we're beginning a second academy on September 16th. This time, with a little bit more time, we're going to be able to do it in 14 weeks.
Hmm. So when you started this, this is really to feed the fire department, but I assume they can use this certification anywhere.
Right, and that's a very interesting question, because it is very competitive to get onto the St. Paul Fire Department. You've got the agility test for one, and the written test, but just in general, you get points for being. I don't even know what the whole structure is, but there's thousands of people who apply for the new list, and usually the list they hire only a few people off the list. So it's a very competitive position, and we knew that a lot of these people, these 40 participants, might not get jobs with the St. Paul Fire Department. Mm. So our strategy was that, in fact, the St. Paul Fire Department is probably more diverse, not probably, I know for sure it's more diverse than any of the other EMS providers in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota, just because of the work they've done over the years, because of various lawsuits, and also because of their just more progressive attitude towards it. So, in fact, what they have is, even though they have more diversity, they also have more competitiveness, because it's probably the higher-paying job around the Twin Cities. So we were prepared to, basically, we had other employers on board, Alina Medical Transportation, so Alina EMS, hires EMTs in the area to work on BLS ambulances and ALS ambulances. And Health East was another partner. And they, too, saw the benefit of having a diverse workforce, hopefully even bilingual workforce. So they were really fast friends and good supporters of this, and provided quite a bit of either cash or in-kind donations, as well as the hospitals. We in the Twin Cities, we hire a lot of EMTs into nursing assistant positions. So everyone was interested, including the Department of Labor and the city's HR offices, to make sure that they would have jobs when they graduated.
All right. So, a lot of questions come to mind. If these guys are trying to be firefighters and the selection process is pretty stiff for that, did you have a stiff selection process to try and weed out people who may not be desirable applicants for what this was originally funneling into?
Well, you have to the two things. One is traditionally the way people recruit for fire departments is you make big advertisement about firefighting. The St. Paul Fire Department is a blended department with both EMS and fire, and so you can't just think of fire, because if you recruit people just for fire, you're going to get a lot of people who just are interested in that. And this particular program was wanting people who could get through or wanted to get through an EMT class. So that's why we call it an EMS Academy and firefighting awareness, instead of vice versa. As far as our stiff requirements, we had stiff requirements not only because we were looking for good EMT potentials, and as you probably are aware of this, passing an EMT class is not a given. So you needed to have people who could read and write, think critically, and read a 1,500-page EMT book in a matter of 10 weeks. You need people who have a clean criminal record, clean enough to pass the national registry and then the state background checks, so that they can do clinicals and they can get certified. And we also had the added constraints about the fact that they had to be within a certain income bracket and living within a certain county. So there was a lot of ifs.
Sure. Did you wind up turning anybody away?
Tons. We had, in 6 days, we actually had 90-plus people in a room that were interested.
Wow.
And we only accepted 25, 24 of which actually showed up to the first day.
Yeah.
So
I bet you had a bigger turnout for your next one in September.
Interestingly, not.
Really?
We are just now going through interviews tomorrow, actually. And we think that part of it is that in the summertime, we had youth that had just graduated, or they knew about the Youth Job Corps, they knew about the city's interest in hiring people for that, and there was already sort of a pool of people who were, especially youth. I think a lot of them, it might be school, it might be, it might just be, I'm not sure, but there's a definite lesser amount. I think we were more like 40 or 50 who are now interested here. And we hope this was a little bit more of a targeted recruitment. The first time around was a blitz approach, anybody and everybody. The second time around, we did the blitz approach, but we also had Workforce Solutions as part of one of our partners, and they have guidance not guidance counselors, but MFIP, which is the new term for welfare counselors, that are case managers, social workers, who did a very targeted recruitment towards 18 to 24 year olds who were in that. Who had an interest in EMS or fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, how almost at the end of the program now, how did it turn out? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's not over yet, so I'm not sure. I can tell you that it's been one of the most exhausting and rewarding and fantastic experiences in my teaching career. I can tell you that that our students are extremely motivated. If you go to www.ehs.net/EMS Academy, EMS Academy being all one word, you will see photographs and see a few of the tools that we used, and see the press release and some of the media coverage. These graduates are amazing. They're many of them are bilingual. They can relate to the populations that we sometimes in EMS don't know how to interface with. They are also motivated not just by the fact that they were paid to be there, but they really are looking for this as a way to end poverty in their family and also just give back to their own communities. And they're incredible people. They're really great.
How many students are still in the program?
We currently have 12. We lost a few because they hadn't disclosed criminal backgrounds. So that was sad that when we actually did the criminal background checks, they were refused. So we lost a few that way. Some of them have had life crises in the process. The number of barriers that exist for people who are trying to get through this are unbelievable. You have people who, first of all, are living in the inner city, don't have a car, can't get to the suburbs where most of the instruction takes place, certainly couldn't pay for extra things like national registry fees and practicals and things that are above and beyond the tuition, even that some of the tuition might not even be covered. But aside from that, when you're struggling to put food on the table for your family and you don't have enough money to feed your kids, there's other things like housing and childcare. There are issues with just being in environments where crime and violence and just past criminal history with either members of your family or members of your community sort of encroaches upon your ability to get out, get yourself out of that situation. And we really, I can't tell you how proud I am of the people who have stuck with it. They've been there. Some of them take 3 buses to come to class. They have a 6-minute window, 2 of them, to drop off their kids into daycare and get the next bus. And if one thing goes wrong, you know, it rains, the bus schedule is off, their kids don't actually get to the bus stop in time, they can't, any number of things would make them late and would get them exited from the program.
Yeah.
So they are, they're really very tenacious, amazing people who have an instinct to survive and an instinct to better themselves, and they're very bright. They're very motivated. They're in some cases, they're single parents who were left by their spouse, male or female, and are caring for multiple children when really they're barely able to get work.
Do you now here in Kentucky, you have to pass a background check before you're even admitted to an EMT class. I guess what you're saying is you had such a quick time to get this done that I guess the background checks on, but they weren't yet on some people. How did that occur?
They were admitted. They began classroom instruction, and we ran the background check on the first day of class. So it takes, in Minnesota, it takes 2 weeks at least to get Health and Human Services, DHHS, to return a background check. So you have to be in progress for a couple of weeks before you'll hear back.
And I imagine that's one of the things you're fixing about the next class is background checks up front. And,
as much as we can. We're definitely running people through background checks this time. I've also learned a lot about the criminal justice system that I didn't expect to learn, such as there are charges that to a layperson sound really bad, but actually to a trained ear really are easily expunged because of either the juvenile court system or the way in which things are charged, and the fact that, you know, you might have been charged with something and you pled for something, and you might not have really, it might not have been a serious crime, or you might have been able to do alternative community service, or you simply didn't pay your parking tickets and suddenly they became a warrant and they became a bigger deal and then you didn't pay it and now you're, so there's all sorts of, there's actually, we have legal aid, they're not called that anymore, but it's a group of lawyers who help with expungements who are looking at cases now that are before us for admission into this next academy going, you know, it might take 6 months, but this actually is kind of a charge that shouldn't really prevent someone from, you know, being in the system. And you know, once you get to know them, you kind of go, wow, that's true. This person was didn't have a lawyer to defend them, and their spouse didn't want to pay child support. So they basically charged them or accused them of making harassing phone calls or something that would allow this person not to have to pay child support. And then because this person didn't have an attorney, couldn't pay an attorney, couldn't defend themselves well enough, they ended up with a terroristic threat or harassing phone call kind of a charge, which, in fact, gets dismissed in some cases, but because it was charged, it ends up on your record. So there's this stuff that kind of follows you around, these ghosts that you'd think, well, you were never convicted of this, but it looks nasty on a piece of paper, and certainly somebody at looking at a background check would have to go, you know, you were convicted of 5th-degree assault when you were a juvenile. Are you now capable of taking care of patients and not assaulting them? And sometimes that 5th-degree assault was all about kind of a, in one case it was a pushing where they were trying to defend themselves, but the arrest record shows that they didn't know who was aggressing on who. So they've been clean for, you know, 6 years. They're young. They were in a place they shouldn't have been at a time they shouldn't have been, and now that will prevent them from going through and becoming or doing anything in healthcare. So it's a lot more complicated than one thing.
Really complicated.
The hoops that some of these students have to go through, it sounds like, you know, when you're describing the challenges, it reminds me of The Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith. And sounds like the makings of a movie, you know, how I started my EMS career. That's incredible.
Yeah. I would say that movie is very, very true. Have you seen Freedom Riders?
No.
Wonderful movie. Really, really summarizes this particular kind of experience as well. And then there's Coach Carter, which Stand and Deliver. Those are two other movies that sort of talk about trying to do work in a population where, you know, most people, they go home and you tell them they have to read the book, they have to study. Well, if you're a single parent and you have to go home and take care of, you know, one, two, three kids, and you don't have access to child care in the evenings, the only time you have child care is during the day, because that's when you get your work, you know, school to work or whatever program you're enrolled in can help you. You've got very limited options, especially culturally. If you're expected to go home and cook dinner for your husband or cook dinner for your family, and you're not expected to be going out there and trying to earn a living, it's not traditional for you to do that. You have a lot more going on when you get back home. You can't just sit down and kick back and read your book and take your online quiz because you don't have internet access.
Yeah.
Heck, one participant, she lives next to the library, right? So you'd think we could have handled that. But the library was under construction. And then when it finally got done and they got new computers, you had a one-hour limit. So you can't study for more than an hour before you get kicked off because somebody wants to check their email.
Wow.
Yeah. How did you have to, you know, take the normal EMT class curriculum? You know, what kind of changes, if any, were made, or you know, what were some of the lessons, I guess, the instructors learned along the way?
Well, we did try to do a few things differently because we knew that we would be dealing with potentially people who maybe didn't graduate from high school or had GEDs or low reading scores. So we tried to provide them with as much technology as we could. The fire department had some laptops that were those tough books that are connected up to the internet with an air card. And we got them a whole bunch of online test-taking products to help them. The class was 240 hours, so we did an EMT curriculum. We also had to include things like the CPR training and the and firefighting awareness, as well as job hunting skills and even just how to, you know, do your resume. We had very strict rules from the Youth Job Corps about attendance and, you know, it's a job, so it's not just going to class. So if you missed or were late three times, you were dismissed. And we had half the day on skills, half the day on lecture. We had study hall or open study sessions where we brought in paramedic students that were volunteering to do review sessions. And so we held only, you know, normally you'd say, well, why don't you get together and do a study group? But if you only travel by bus and the environments where you're going to assemble to study are filled with kids, you know, it's hard to study. So we held study sessions where we would have them bring their kids, and the kids would play. And you know, I don't know. Sunday I was there, and we had kids playing in one room. We had adults working on test questions in another to make it work.
I have kind of an interesting. I don't know. I just want to run this by you. I'm trying to wrap my head around this concept because I would have to, in order to teach this course, I would have to throw away about half of my preconceived notions about what's going on. Maybe you've had the same experience. But I have this speech that I do in front of every EMT and paramedic class that I teach. And the speech is, your life needs to be in order before you take this course, you know. And I tell them, I know your life is busy, but if you have 7 jobs and you have 8 kids and you're a single parent, this is not the time for you to become a paramedic or an EMT. Yes, I know your life is hard. I know it sucks. I know you want a better job, but if you're never in class, I cannot help you. If you cannot read your book, I cannot help you. And I do this, and I'm mean. I slam stuff on the table, and I try and scare them off. I try and shoo them away if they can't do that. And yet, here you are. You're trying to attract these people. You're making a class out of people whose lives are not in order. I don't know what I'd do. in that vein, how is that working?
Well, I mean, we have you know, 50% attrition at this point, so I wouldn't say it worked out so well. A lot of the attrition had been from, you know, 3 people left because school started and they wanted to pursue something else, and the summer job ended. So I wouldn't say that those were attrition because they somehow couldn't handle it or didn't, you know. There was some other reasons, and the criminal background piece was also a major one.
Well, in light of the circumstances, 50% is not all that surprising. And you know, when you said that, I thought that's actually not bad. That's pretty good.
Well, yeah. I mean, we'll hold our breath until we get everybody through the test. But I think, you do have a lot of people who have barriers. We had one participant who couldn't see out of one eye and had trouble reading. She had one eye was blurry, so it's really hard for her to read. So she didn't let us know that. And, you know, halfway through the program where she was failing some tests, we sort of start to gather that maybe, you know, she's very motivated and she's actually wonderful. She was selling plasma to get enough bus money. You know, we got her a bus card from one of the caseworkers and got her some money to do that. And we got her an eye appointment, which even though she ended up eventually failing out of the program, we still got her glasses and she still knew how to do CPR. And hopefully with glasses and a little bit more kind of time to get her ducks in a row, could make another run at it. So, you know, what do you do with someone who, I'll tell you another story. She's there. Two participants are pregnant just recently. One of them just recently had found out. And her husband was killed because he was buried by garbage. He worked as a garbage hauler. And he was only under the garbage for maybe a couple minutes, really very quick. They dug him out. But he suffocated, and nobody knew how to do CPR. And she's sitting there, and she says, you know, I don't know if this is going to work out for me. I'm pregnant, and I'm not sure how I can do this. But I couldn't believe that nobody could help my husband, and I really don't ever want that to happen to anybody else. So I want to be an EMT.
Wow, that's an incredible story. Okay, but I have to ask, she was selling her plasma?
Oh, this is a different, the woman who was pregnant.
This is the one with the eye.
The other one with the eye was selling plasma.
Okay, well, when you say plasma, are we talking blood?
Yeah.
You can sell your blood in the United States?
Yeah.
Oh,
if you have certain blood types, you can. It's pretty good money sometimes. Yeah.
I'm O negative. I'm moving to the U.S.
Dave, the thing, and I think I can hear it in your voice, and you know, my own misty eyes right now of some of these stories. If like, you know, it's tough enough to sort of clock out at the end of the day as a EMT instructor. Like, how did you and the other instructors sort of manage the, you know, you got in deep with these kids in terms of their personal lives, and I'm imagining that took a toll on all of you. Did you realize that was going to happen coming in? And then once it started happening, how is that affected you or the other people involved in teaching?
Well, we're in the middle of it, so I got to tell you, my misty eyes aren't done yet. And you know, you're all invited, and Greg, in particular, since you can actually drive over, I would invite you to come and be at the graduation next Thursday, because I don't think there'll be a dry eye in the place. I think we have great instructors. We just really do. And they couldn't make it to this podcast tonight because one of them is on an ambulance and the other one is actually sleeping after an ambulance shift, after teaching, sleep, you know, teaching, working, teaching, you know, needed to get some sleep. So we are completely engaged. I would say everybody in the fire department, and let me qualify, the college taught the course. So Ember Hills is the entity that gave the course, and we were supported by the fire department in that we had assistant instructors and all sorts of guest speakers. But everyone, and I would say everyone, even this happened to be the location of the course is across the hall from the fire department headquarters. So a lot of the old, you know, folks that are deputy chiefs and district chiefs who come in on a regular basis to just kind of check things in, they would stop in the classroom and work with them on, you know, vital signs or just listen and cheer them on. And I, you know, we know their names now. I mean, they're just, it's not, you can't disengage. You just can't. You get a phone call in the middle of the night, somebody's, you know, having trouble kind of getting themselves to class the next day because, you know, they're at the hospital with their father who just had a, you know, big problem. And you go, what can I do? I
mean,
We had one who passed out during the first week of class. They couldn't have breakfast. They don't eat breakfast. They're getting their kids out the door to get them into daycare by, you know, 6, 7, 7:30 in the morning, so they can get themselves over to class. And there's no time in there, nor there is cash to eat breakfast. So you know, you buy bagels and you just kind of move on.
Kind of a question for you. Now, as far as the fire department mandate here, because the fire department wants firefighters who are EMT certified, and you're working hard to produce this, and you're bending over backwards, and I commend you. And this may sound, because everybody, this may sound like the old curmudgeon kind of question here, but if you're having so many problems just getting this class off the line, back to my previous comment about your life needs to be in order before you take this course. You're asking these people to enter into a line of work that is very time demanding. You're going to be gone for 24 hours. You're not going to have. How does somebody who's having trouble getting through this course get into a profession that may be even more demanding on your time and have a stranger schedule and whatnot? Do you think that? The people who are left in your course and who are graduate candidates are going to be a good fit for the demanding schedule requirements for this profession?
I think it's an entirely different game when you have a job.
Yeah.
I think that when you earn wages and you can have daycare that you can pay for, especially a starting salary in the city of St. Paul and the fire department is going to be anywhere in the neighborhood of $40,000-$41,000 a year. I think you are able to pay for housing, pay for daycare. You can stand up, and I think that when you can't find a job and you have no job skills, no certifications, you don't have the benefit of the inside track on things you could get. I think that plays a huge role in it. I also think they're young.
Well, you know, I hope this is the case. I really hope this is the case, and I hope that's successful. But around here, where in Kentucky, where the mandatory shift is one of those just ominous things that's always hanging over somebody's head, I've seen a lot of people who are single parents who gave up their profession, just said, "I can't do this. I need a job where people work regular hours and somebody's not going to call me in at 7 p.m., and I don't know where my kids are going to sleep tonight." And, you know, this is ridiculous, and they leave the profession in disgust over
that. I mean, that's not I mean, that's not unique to the 12 students left in this program. I mean, that's a potential problem.
I'm just saying that people are, I mean, it's hard enough to do that if you have resources at your disposal. But if you start,
And I think it's also different, too, when you're talking about 24-hour shifts, and you have to sort of keep in mind that that not all of these folks, in fact, most of them, never envisioned being a firefighter before the day that they saw the posting, that many of them actually see themselves working in a hospital and working as a nursing assistant in the hospital until they can go either to nursing school or maybe PA school. So I think might work as an EMT doing shift work for that time. So I don't know that this is all about that exact population.
Well, I do agree
with you.
And I look at this as a program that's very important, and it should be done. But I also look at, you know, the way money is spent, and federal money is being spent, and Homeland Security money, and what was the purpose of it to make firefighters. And, my gosh, if you paid, like, 24 people $750 to go to the EMT program, and you paid all the instructors, and, I mean, that sounds like a just ballpark $50,000, $70,000 project, maybe more.
It's just, and I think it sounds like, without knowing the system all that well, it sounds like a short-term investment for kind of a long-term gain. Because, you know, even if you have a really high attrition rate, if you can, you know, get 30, 40, 50% of those people out of, you know, a lifestyle of perpetual poverty and struggle and dependency on the federal government, the return on the investment is really exceeds the initial cost, I would imagine.
The return on the investment sounds awesome, but and I don't want to sound like too much the curmudgeon. I just, like, when you define monies like this, if this was meant to feed the fire department and they get, like, one employee out of it and you spent almost $100,000 doing it, somebody might get really mad at the way that money was spent. If you have a broader goal and say, hey, we're trying to get jobs for these people, we're not really trying to feed the fire department, we're trying to do this. You know what I mean?
Does that sound crazy? You have to understand. I think that the idea, first of all, to get communities, especially communities of color, involved in their fire department, aware of what it takes to become a firefighter, and encouraging the next generation, whether they're at this point 10 years old today or they're about to turn 18, that's an incredible investment and will come back to the fire department in many different ways, not the least of which is that by preparing these folks, and especially, you know, in cultures where you need bilingual translators, the return on that investment, I think, is more of a longer-term vision. These folks, you have to remember, we're going to get paid $7.50 an hour to go work at a park and rec job doing parks maintenance, and at the end of the summer, we're going to be laid off and be expected to either go back to school or do anything else. They're youth, and they're you know, the idea that instead of drawing a paycheck from the government for welfare, you're actually put to work and you're helping your community. Well, I would venture to say that every one of these family members are going to show up for their agility test demonstration next Thursday, and they have, I'm sure, taught everybody in their family how to do CPR, and or at least are embedded now into communities where they can value EMS, they can see what that profession does. And again, they will still be working in the area, even if they wouldn't work for the fire department, or as they prepare and fix their lives to gain entry into the fire department. You know, there'll be a test in January, but historically there's tests every, you know, few years, 5 years maybe. You keep a list around for 2, 3, 5 years. So, you know, it might be another 5-year return on this investment, but in 5 years, you may have a whole other sort of generation of people ready.
Do you think?
A couple questions for you, Dave.
Go ahead, Doug.
Oh, thanks. Where'd you come up with the idea to continue their pay from Parks and Rec and be in a
time when everybody's, well, cutting their budgets, particularly municipalities, states, all of that. I mean, budgets are really tight, and regardless of how many thousands of dollars, that money had to be hard to come up with.
Oh, I think it's, first off, some of that is stimulus money, so it definitely is a federal initiative to try and get people into work situations. So there is quite a bit of research on spending the dollars up front on, you know, and it's partly, I think, administrative philosophy and politics, so I'm not even going to get into that. That's just, you know, beyond the scope of all of this. But the concept that instead of roaming the streets on in the summer, you have a job and you're working gets youth, especially youth at risk, into you have to get them off the street, get them doing something productive for the community. And so those programs have been in place for very many years. In fact, there's both nonprofit, church-based type of activity that is based on that, and then nonprofits like the Youth Job Corps, which is a national project. The Goodwill does incredible work with that, where they're taking folks and employing them in either whether it's the stores or getting them ready for construction jobs. There's lots of examples of that, especially with you know, women in the trades, for example. You probably know it's a good analogy to use. Construction work, even in the jobs within construction that are not manual, have traditionally been given to men. And there are lots of jobs within construction that women could do, and unfortunately did never have access to it. So there's projects that got started to try and, you know, deal with those inequities and get parents, especially low-income folks, into those positions. And they've been very successful.
Have you guys ever thought about, and I've actually thought about this a couple times, I've never had the budget. It's always fallen through, and of course legally it gets complicated really quick. But with Homeland Security money or bailout or stimulus money, this may be possible. Have you ever thought about providing child care during the hours of your course?
We,
fix it right there.
Right. You know? Well, yeah, and it actually, at the college, there is a child care center, and financial aid does cover child care, or, you know, any number of social welfare-type programs cover child care. For this program, the participants that had kids had caseworkers, and they had daycares that were already pre-established. So it was very hard, you know, to get somebody into the system and get them all established. But I like your idea, and I think it's worth it, definitely.
Yeah, sometimes I think, you know, because I've even thought about this, too. If you have 25 students, and you're paying, especially if you're paying them, like $7.50 an hour to show up, how much are you going to pay a child care worker to watch their kids, you know, for the ones who need to be there? Maybe if you subtract two students and now you're going with 23, but you have child care with it, and that money that would be going to pay for the other two is going to the child care worker, you might have a much higher yield out of that course.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. It's hard to select. It's really difficult to figure out what the balance is between what they need, you know, and what they already have. And if they already have child care through a parent or a family member, and you don't have to provide it, then it's probably better for that to, you know, if grandma's going to watch the kid, then it's probably better for that to occur than to try and meet that. So it's a hodgepodge, and I think a lot of it has to do with sort of scrounging, you know, figuring out what works for one person may not work for another. But we did provide child care, whether we was organized or paid or not, and we also provided.
In some of my evening classes, I've had as many as, like, three kids playing in the next room at the firehouse. I mean, that's why it came up so often. And, you know, if you get a guy who's been in your paramedic course and he's got so much invested in it and something horrible happens to his schedule and he's got no child coverage for the next month, I mean, you just can't kick him out of your course, you know. You got to try and do something. And, I know where you're coming from. It's just it's hard to maintain standards with the kind of lives that people bring to your classroom now. And it seemed like it was easier in the old days to go, okay, you know, you're out of here, you're done. But, you know, I'd have to kick out probably 90% of my students if I didn't take lifestyle or, you know, life hardships into account. And, I wrestle with that. And that's why I was asking those hard questions. You know, I don't want you to feel bad and say, oh, Buck's a curmudgeon.
No,
he says,
no.
This sucks, you know. I mean, these are the obvious questions you got to think about because, you know, you wonder, I'm spending a lot of federal money. And what kind of yield am I going to get out of this? If I produce one firefighter for this department and I spend $100,000, was that a good use of that money? Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure you've wrestled with this. I was
And let me tell you, too, just to set the record straight, we got donations to cover the cost of training. So there are four foundations, the St. Paul Foundation, our Bigelow Foundation, the United Way, Otto Bremer. Those people paid for training, so it was private dollars that paid for the training.
Wow,
and
that's nice.
The cost of the really the stimulus money was there to put people to work. So the concept of earn while you learn, and you know, get you off the street and get you aware of what trauma does, that definitely was. I wouldn't say even if those taxpayers, you know, because I'm a taxpayer in the city of St. Paul, and I definitely want to see the fire department be diverse, but I know that out of these 12 that'll graduate, they'll work in hospitals, they'll work in ambulance services, and I don't see it as having been a failure if we only have one firefighter graduating, because I think the fire department, as a member of the community, providing EMS now, we're talking about not necessarily the fire suppression side, but the EMS side, has just converted a whole group of folks, families and participants included, into being a lot more aware of what the EMS system does, what's appropriate, what's not, and prepared people who are in those communities to better respond to a crisis. So,
yeah, I think the whole notion of the thing is right on, and you know even the cost is. I mean, that same stimulus money went to bought the chassis on a fire truck. I mean, instead you had 12 students in the classroom 25 hours a week gaining a job skill and life skills. And I think the whole concept is amazing, and I applaud you guys for the effort. And I can imagine that it's been just physically and emotionally draining. And congratulations to you and to the students.
Well, come on down and shake their hands, because you will be amazed. And yeah, we're not there yet, so we need to all 12 of them passed the National Registry Practical 2 days ago. Now we need to get them through the written.
Okay.
And that's not, that's not a small feat. So I would say you got to come down and meet them and do your next podcast from their graduation day, because the mayor will speak, and it'll be a very interesting experience.
That sounds cool. Well,
I would love to, but actually I have a child care issue of my own next Thursday. That's going to keep
you. You'd have to take 84 buses to get there from Wisconsin. And,
you know, just to wrap this up, I think there's a future podcast, and Doug might have some connections with some of the maybe Indian reservations in New Mexico, or me here
definitely
in Wisconsin, or even Rob with, the First Nation groups in Canada, because I think we're talking about some similar issues, and I imagine there's EMS educators that have taught for those groups that could share their experiences. So if we have listeners that are thinking, yeah, I've been there, done that, with a similar set of, students struggling with life issues, et cetera, boy, we'd love to hear from you and try to get you on the show.
We need a whole podcast. That is starting to really, because like I said, I've been trying to wrap my head around that. And, you know, I kind of had the old educator idea that, okay, well, you're supposed to be here. You're not here, so you're out of my class. We're done. And you can't do that anymore. You can't. Or you won't have any sort of yield. People's lives, especially with this terrible economy, are kind of out of order all the time. And if you're going to make things better, and I applaud you, Mr. Page, for, you know, stepping in there and saying, you know, I'm going to take personal responsibility for it. I'm going to try and make this happen. And I'm starting to realize that I need to change my thinking along that idea, and I'm fascinated by the concept. But obviously, you know, there are times where you can go too far. How far do you go in these limits? And we need to check back in with you after a while and see, you know, what kind of successes you're having. Yeah.
If I'd had I've been so tired and running so ragged. What I should have had is some of these participants on the call.
Oh yeah.
Because I think hearing Candace's story from Candace, not from repeated by me, is much more powerful and much more important. So first off, we'll definitely the city cable is going to carry the graduation, and the person who I was speaking about that had her husband die is going to be speaking at that graduation. So we'll link it to the website so people can see that.
Sure, yeah.
But you know, please don't think that this was something that Dave Page came up with. Really, it's Chief Butler, it's Luz Frias, it's the City of St. Paul, and it's a whole lot of people who kind of had been working on how is it that we could do this differently and do it better. And we're not the first, I don't think, because if you talk to Gabe Romero at the National Registry, who was in Denver, and I would encourage you to go looking over in Denver, Denver Health, was equally concerned about their minorities and recruitment in that area, and had created a BLS ambulance service where EMTs could be working while they went to school. So the concept was they had their own school, they put people through EMT and then hired them to work for them while they went through their own paramedic program so that they would have a diverse workforce. And that program was incredibly successful and was reaching into high schools. So there are people out there who've done this and probably have way more experience than anything we're doing today.
Well, thanks again for being part of the EduCast and
yes,
those
please.
Resources. And please pass our best to the whole team, and we'll look forward to hearing more about it. And I think Buck's going to get us out of here with his usual wrap-ups.
Well, sure. And, yeah, and in the future, I really would like to talk to some graduates and some of your new students from the new class. I'd like to revisit this, like, fairly soon, maybe. But we'll talk about that behind the scenes. But anyway, everybody, thanks to David Page for coming out tonight. He is always a fascinating guest. And this isn't the last time we're going to talk to you. I guarantee you that. And as always, we have Rob Terrio, and thank you for coming, sir. And Rob, are you still around?
Sorry, I had to unmute my mic.
That's okay.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
I was gonna give you a chance to plug your blog and stuff. You're doing such interesting stuff over there lately. Yeah, tell us what's going on.
Well, my blog is paramedictutor.wordpress.com, and I'm throwing up lots of multimedia presentations, some online learning stuff there that's free and hopefully interesting and helpful.
Oh, awesome, awesome. And Doug Godomsky, where can we find you if we're social media types and we want to get a hold of you?
Hey, there you go. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook as well. And out there, I've got a wiki site or two spread here and there that is lots of fun to play with. And that's another social media in itself, or a great adjunct for teaching. So. But that's another show.
All right. And Greg Fries, where do we start? Just give us two or three.
just Twitter is my favorite place to be, but also Facebook. My Twitter handle is at gfreeze. And then the other thing that I'm excited about these days is a screencasting tool called Screener, screener.com. For educators putting together screencasts, it's super easy to use. You can download, you can put them on YouTube, you can embed in a blog. Educators should check that out. If you've never made a screencast, go there and make one, and then tell me about it. I want to see what you make.
Hey, you've done a couple of great ones there, Greg.
I'm just playing around with it, trying to.
I have a use for that right now. What's it called again? What's the web address?
Screener. screener.com.
N-R, not an N-E-R?
Right.
Oh, okay.
I'll send you the link.
Okay.
And you can put that in the show notes.
Sure.
And, Dave just reminds us that the website for his program is ehs.net/EMS Academy.
All right. And I've got that down for the show notes as well. And I am Buck Ferris. You can follow me. Sometimes I'm embarrassed at what's up on the internet with me. You can see me at my hardly ever updated blog at gomerville.com. It's been down for the last couple of weeks, but there will be some new material up there in the next couple of weeks. You can catch me at copycode3.com, which is a little podcast I do. It's got a slant towards individual interviews with providers. you can also find me on Twitter at buckman.com, where I've had apparently I've created a meme by imitating Paramedic Dan in my own weird way. A few other places if you catch me. Sometimes we talk in the garage. But thank you so much, David Page, for coming by. This has been fascinating. And, I'd sound like curmudgeon, but I wanted to ask those hard questions, not because I don't support the program. I do, but I've had such problems with tackling the kind of stuff that you seem to have just turned around head on and said, you know what, I'm going to do that. And I find that so fascinating. And I've just been, I need to find more ways to incorporate kind of what you're doing. I wish you the best of luck. And, whenever you're making somebody's life better, that's what education is all about. And I commend you and all the other people as part of the program. And we will talk to you again soon about this.
Well, thank you. I'm very honored you brought me on the show, and I really appreciate it. So good job, and thank you. And those are not hard questions. They're good questions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and thank you to our listeners. And if you enjoyed the show, come on by. Boy, we got a lot of other ones. We're getting more and more listeners every once in a while as the weeks go by. And you can contact us, too, at emsedgecast@gmail.com. We've gotten some good feedback through there. But we also want to know what we're doing wrong. What would you like to hear? If you just hate me and you want to hear more of Greg, tell us. And we'll hook you up. Some other subjects. Actually, we've got some pretty good suggestions about future guests from an email we got recently. And I'm looking forward to following that up. But keep listening, and we'll keep producing, and we'll all keep educating and trying to make this a world a better place and put more EMTs and paramedics in it. And be back next week. Thank you, and good night.